Can I just tell you, Anna was not actually going to be preaching this morning, and she was asked yesterday if she could step in and preach. So I just want to honour her this morning for doing that. And I think we're just going to trust, Anna, that no matter how you're feeling, and you know, you can see by her face that this is it. It's a bit of cost, but we're just ready to receive what the Lord has, and we don't care however it comes out of your mouth. So, we've been doing the Sermon on the Mount series, so it will be, you'll notice a little skip. So what Anna was going to share last week, she's had to rush and try and finish for today. So it might not be as polished as she wanted, but let's pray for Anna, and then we're just going to give her a massive round of applause because she's already won. Okay. Thank you, Jesus. Thank you for Anna. Thank you for what she's prepared and what's in her heart. And we ask that you'd fill her with boldness and freedom this morning to just speak it out. Make us ready to receive. God, this is for you, and we just want to hear from you this morning. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay, let's give her that round of applause. Woo-hoo!
Highly awkward. I'd love to tell you, I actually got the call from Pete yesterday when I was on a silent retreat, and I'd love to tell you that what happened was I was sitting in the chapel and I was contemplating the Lord. The truth is, it was with college, the truth is that I was in the pub with a pint watching the rugby. Hopefully my lecturers won't listen to this because they would be angry with me. Here we are. We're looking at the last book of Matthew. I'm also going to cut out a whole load of things that I was going to say. So you're going to see some slides rush past you. Ignore them. They're not any very interesting anyway. So we're coming to the end of this series. And these last few passages that we're looking at, they're basically Jesus summing up his teaching of that he's been giving to the disciples or these people. And this is basically him saying, it's like, okay, are you going to implement what I've told you to do? Are you actually going to do what I've asked you to do? And they would have had, they would have been used to rabbis coming around and offering teachings. They would have had different peoples turn up in Galilee and say, this is our teaching. And then they would decide as to whether they wanted to take on that teaching. But the thing is, it's different about Jesus' teaching. And it says right at the end of the chapter, I'm just going to read it out quickly. They were astonished at his teaching, for that he was teaching as one who had authority, not like their scribes. So the teachers that would come around, what they were teaching was the authorized stuff. What they were teaching was stuff that they would have known. They would have come from different schools, but it would have been authorized, kind of ordained and regulated. And then this teacher, this rabbi, comes around along with something totally different. And that would have been unsettling for them to hear it, but they're starting to see that this guy isn't someone that is regurgitating stuff that other people have said. He is speaking with authority, something that is coming from a different place, and they're shocked by it and they're amazed by it. We're also, just to make it all more difficult for you to follow, we're also going to start from the bottom of the chapter and work our way up just for fun, because that feels like the right thing to do. Okay, oh, nice bit of pottery. Terrible bit of pottery that I made. Intense quote from a very intelligent man. We're going to skip it, and we're going to go straight to the passage. Okay. So, we're going to skip this one too. Okay, anyone who hears these words of mine and does not do them is like the wise man who built his house on the rock, and the rain fell and the floods came and the wind blew and beat on the house, but it did not fall because it had been founded on the rock. And everyone who hears these words of mine and does them will not be like the foolish man who built his house on the sand. When the rain fell and the floods came, the winds blew and beat against that house, it fell, and great was the fall of it. I think this might be some of that Jesus humor that we might have heard. And you kind of hope, it doesn't really go down well with us, but you kind of hope for Jesus' sake that in the first century, like, they would have laughed and been lolling. Otherwise, Jesus is facing a terrible career in comedy. But it's ridiculous. It's foolish. As if anyone would ever build their house on sand. Isn't that stupid? Isn't that foolish? Isn't that ridiculous? Of course you would build your house on a rock. Because sand's going to melt away as soon as the winds come, as soon as the rains come, as soon as the flood comes. It's not going to be able to stand. And we can tell, like, even from today, what we've been hearing about, it's like the winds will come, the flood will come, the rain will come. Where are you standing? Where are your feet? What are you basing your life on? And Jesus is really unambiguous. He says, base your teachings on me, because that is the only place that's going to be stable. trust me because I am the one who is going to keep you safe during the when the rains come, when the wind comes, when the flood comes. You will be able to stand. I will be secure. These teachings are mine. Trust them. And the question is, are we going to implement them? We've heard all this stuff, and it's been hard teaching that we've been listening to in the Sermon on the Mount. It's practical, and it's tough, but are we actually going to implement it? Go back to that intelligent guy, Scott McKnight. Followers of Jesus follow Jesus and his teaching. Those who don't follow Jesus are not followers. It's really clear. Are we going to implement what we've been hearing about? Are we going to follow him? Do we actually want to build our lives on the teaching of Jesus? And essentially, this end of the passage is like a sales pitch of Jesus saying, you know, all those other teachings that those rabbis have, all those other false prophets. He said, are you going to listen to them or are you going to listen to me? And early on in the passage, it says, beware of the false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly are ravenous wolves. You will recognize them by their fruits. Are grapes gathered from thorn bushes or figs from thistles? So every healthy tree bears good fruit, but the diseased tree bears bad fruit. A healthy tree cannot bear bad fruit, nor can a diseased tree bear good fruit. Every tree that does not bear good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire. Thus you will recognize them by their fruit. What I love about this is Jesus is basically, as Becky said, is teaching the people to grow up and recognize, what are you consuming? Are you consuming good fruit or are you consuming bad fruit? Because these teachers are going to come and they're going to show you their wares, and you're going to have to choose like whether you trust them or not. And he's saying, wake up, beware. Not everybody wants to give you good things. Not everyone has your best interests at heart. Wake up, mature, grow up. Don't just accept everything that you hear. And the question is, how can we trust Jesus? How can we trust Jesus that he actually is the good tree bearing good fruit? And this is, as he's saying this, it is almost like he's inviting them to say, test me. Test me. Is my fruit good? Am I one of the good trees or am I one of the bad trees? And we, in our lives, I probably have to be more alert to this sort of, to this activity than they would have been in the first century. Because in the first century, the teachers coming around would have been really obvious. They would have presented their case. They would have said, these are our beliefs, these are our values, this is how we think you should live your life in light of the Torah. And whereas we, our teachers, are far more subtle. It comes in so many different forms. It'd be great if someone could come around and say, this is individualism. These are our beliefs. These are our practices. Choose whether you want to sign up or not. It'd be so much easier if that was the case, but it isn't the case. And I can promise you that the teachers that we have, they don't necessarily want our best at heart. Do you think advertisers want the best at heart? They're thinking about their profits. They're trying to tell us that you're not good enough as you are. They're deliberately trying to make you feel like you lack something. That is not someone who has your best interests at heart. You could go through a whole load of different things, of things that we're bombarded with day after day after day. It's like, do we really think that these things have our best interests at heart? The question is, who does have our best interests at heart? Jesus, can we trust you? And there's many things you can say about Jesus, but one thing you can't say about him is that he's definitely not a ravenous wolf. Again, I don't know if this is humor, it may be, it may not be, but a wolf dressed up as a sheep sounds mildly amusing to me. Either way, a wolf for them would have been incredibly dangerous. It would have been an incredible threat to their sheep and to them. It would have been like the hyenas in Lion King, like Mufasa. You say a wolf. But a wolf pretending to be a sheep, pretending to be someone that's good for you on your side, well, that's just deceitful. A ravenous wolf is greedy, who never gets filled with anything, whose appetites never stop. A ravenous wolf wants to destroy and kill. And Jesus' way may be hard and it may be challenging and it may be costly, but I can tell you what, there is not a single hint of deceit in him. throughout his life, he confronts hypocrisy again and again. He's like so honest. It's not, I was going to say to a fault, but that's wrong. He's so honest that it just gets into him so much trouble because he can't but be anything but himself. You can't call him greedy because he's utterly selfless. And even though his way seems like it's leading away to death, it actually brings about far more life than we can possibly comprehend. And Jesus measures up as the good tree. He measures up as the one who wants good things for us. His fruit is good. It nourishes us. And Jesus has proved himself worthy, and we've been singing about it earlier, because of his cross, because of his resurrection, because he chose to come and live amongst us. He chose by his incarnation to embrace us. And he chose to die for us, that when he was on the cross, he, even though we were still far off, he chose to die for us. Even though we were his enemies, he chose to die for us. And in his resurrection, he's victorious in the two things that bind us and hold us, sin and death. He's victorious over sin. He's victorious over death. But perhaps that's just not good enough for us. Perhaps still then we can't trust him. And the reality is that is a blockage for a lot of us as to why we don't actually implement this stuff. Because we don't truly trust that what his way is good for us. We don't truly trust him. We trust ourselves. We trust other people. We trust other narratives and other voices. And what terrifies me about Jesus is that he seems to let us choose. It says, "Enter by the narrow gate, for the gate is wide and the way is easy that leads to destruction, and those who enter it by it are many. For the gate is narrow and the way is hard that leads to life, and those who find it are few." Like, if I was Jesus, I would force people to go down the narrow way. I'd be forcing them. But he gives us a choice. He says, "Are you going to trust me? Are you going to build your life on me? Are you going to trust that I have good things for you? Are you going to throw the full weight of your faith on me?" And what Jesus is tapping into as he says these verses about narrow way, he's tapping into a load of Jewish writings that would have come before. In Deuteronomy, it says, "See, I've set a way before you today, life and good, death and evil, if you obey these commandments of the Lord your God that I command you today, by loving the Lord your God, by walking in his ways and keeping his commandments and his statutes and his rules, then you shall live and multiply. And the Lord will bless you in the land that you are entering to take possession of it. But if your hearts turn away and you will not hear and you are drawn away to worship other gods and serve them, I declare to you today that you shall surely perish and you shall not live in the land that you are going over to in the Jordan to enter and possess. I call heaven and earth to witness against you today that I have set before you life and death, blessing and curses. Therefore choose life." Like, it seems obvious, isn't it? Surely you would choose life. And this in Jeremiah: "Stand by the roads," or crossroads in another translation, "and look and ask for the ancient paths. Where is the good way, and walk in it and find rest for your souls?" By walking the way of his way, we find rest for our souls. But as we've been hearing through this series, actually the way of Jesus is really hard. It's really costly. It means denial, it means sacrifice, it means giving up my rights. And actually, sometimes it's much easier to go the way that everybody else is going, because it's actually a little bit easier as well. I'd rather be inoculated. I'd rather take shortcuts and compromise, because sacrifice, suffering, denial just seem too hard. But this motif of the cost of following Jesus goes right the way through the Gospels. And you can't escape it. You just can't escape it in the teaching and the life of Jesus. Because the way of Jesus is the way of the cross. And in many ways, it's slightly awkward to say that, because you're saying to people, "Yeah, you know, choose the way of death." That seems insane. It seems mad. But the reason I can confidently say it is because you know what stands behind it is life. And we heard about it in that really gross picture of the nail. I'm so sorry about your toe. But don't show me later. But that after death comes life. And we have to hold on to that. After death comes life. Life will come. Life will flow. And I want to talk about a little bit, just for the last few minutes, about something that is a way that I've seen this work out in my life, where I can say that there's been times when I've chosen death and I've actually encountered life. And I want to talk about that in the context of singleness. And firstly, the reason I want to talk about singleness is because I felt like God asked me to, which is a good enough reason, isn't it? Secondly, is I know that singleness is costly, and there are many in the church who face that, and it feels like a really costly thing, and they desperately want it to be spoken about. So here we go, I'm speaking about it. And thirdly, it's part of my story. And I can truly say when I've actually, when I've done the hard work of obedience, it has, in fact, led to life. And a few things I just want to say about singleness and marriage is, first of all, both are costly calls. Singleness and marriage both have costs. Marriage, I've heard, is really hard, and there's cost to it. Singleness is really hard, and there's cost to it. But marriage, apparently, is a real blessing. And singleness, I genuinely believe, can be a blessing. However, in our sexualized culture, where you're only valid as a person by having sex, and we're in a church, and not saying KXC, but as the church as a whole, we have idolized marriage, and I totally understand why we've done that. We've wanted to protect marriage, and I believe in marriage fiercely, and I think it's an amazing thing. But when we becomes an idol, like, it's just, it destroys our hearts. And it has become an idol. And all those things make it hard and make it a challenge to be single, and it makes it costly to be single. And also on top of that, you've got the emotional side. You've got to manage your emotions as well as everybody else's emotions. I've got a funny story about a wedding that I went to about 2 years ago, two summers ago. Three funny things happened, but I'm only going to tell you one. It was a family wedding, and I was with my parents. And my mum was talking to this guy, and they were standing there looking at me and nodding like this. And I was like, they're talking about me, obviously. I have no idea who this guy is. And I asked my dad, and he's like got a tie around his head because it's that time of the night. And and I was like, who is that? And they said, oh, it's some relative. So I was like, okay, fine. I just walk over. I'd never met this guy before. And as I walk over to them, because they're obviously talking about me, my mum walks off. So I introduce myself to this guy who doesn't introduce himself back. And he said, your mum's been telling me about your situation. And I was like, I saw the funny side. You obviously didn't. And I was like, I know exactly what he's talking about, but I'm going to make him say it. And I was like, well, what situation's that? And he said that you're single. And I was like, ah, did my mum also tell you that I really love my job? I said, I absolutely adore my life. I have a lot of friends. I'm really, really content. Did she tell you that? And he didn't quite know what to say, and the conversation very swiftly finished. Anyway, I've screwed up in a lot of areas, but this is one that I've really wanted to pay close attention to, because I've seen it done badly in church. I've seen a lot of women and men get bitter and get angry get angry at men and get hard and unable to celebrate other people's joy. And I've thought, actually, I don't want to do that. I don't want to be that person. God, if you're calling me to follow you, there's got to be a way that this brings life to me. And I've not always got it right. Honestly, I've had my diva moments. I remember, I don't often have outbursts, but I remember one very significant outburst. It was when a few years ago, I've got a sister, and at the time she was married, and my parents as well. And whenever the conversations in the family about what we were doing, I was always outnumbered, which just used to really irritate me. And then my niece came along, and I love my niece to pieces, but she then became the focus as well. And I was like, I'm really struggling here. And anyway, I usually like say things when things are bothering me, but this time I didn't. I just let it build up and build up. And one night, we're planning the day, and we planned a really great afternoon and a really great morning, blah, blah, blah. But I wake up in the morning, and I'm obviously the last one to wake up because I've got no reason to get up. And I don't have kids. There's got to be some joys. I'm the last to wake up, and they've decided to change the plans. And they're all going off, and I'm left on my own. And I was just like, that's not very nice. And my sister Tan said, yep, you're single, you can do what you want whenever you want. And I screamed and went, don't you think I want what you've got? Ran up to the toilet, slammed the door, cried, howled. She broke into the toilet, how, I don't know. Came in, I told her, don't you touch me. Anyway, I haven't always dealt with it with dignity. Anyway, there was one time I was really struggling with it. And I was driving along in my car, and I was just having a go at God about it. I was like, it's so unfair. And he said, Anna, what do you want? And I said, I've told you what I want. I want a husband, I want kids. He said, Anna, what do you want? I said, do you want me to repeat it? Anna, what do you want? I want to see my parents come to faith. Anna, what do you want? I want to lead a church. Anna, what do you want? And it just kept on going on and on and on. And at the core of it, when he finally got to what I really wanted, I was like, Jesus, I want you. Jesus, I want you. Above all else, I want you. And whether I'm single, whether married, I want you. And I can tell you now that he has been the best friend, the most encouraging husband I could ever want. He's provided for me. He's comforted me. And the Bible is incredibly positive about singleness. It says, actually, do you know what? Jesus was single. Paul was single. And it says, do you know what? Because you're single, you can get to devote yourself to the Lord. And there's a joy in that I get to devote myself to the Lord, that I don't have to think about what somebody else wants to do. I get to think about what he wants to do and what we get to do together. And there is joy that comes from doing that. And I can't give you the hard and fast rules of how to cope with this cost. But I can say, nurture your desire for Jesus. And the joy that has come from it, it means that I get to celebrate what I do have. I get to celebrate that I do have a job that I love. I get to celebrate that I have amazing friendships, an incredible church. I've got 5 godchildren. I've got a gorgeous nephew and niece who I adore. And I don't spend my time thinking about all the things that I don't have. So how dare anyone, you know, the world say that I'm to be pitied when I have such a full life? And there's costs for all of us that the Lord is calling us to make. Whether it's relationally, financially, our time. But Jesus says, trust me, give your life to me. I'm good, I'm secure. When the crap hits the fan, you can trust me. And interestingly, when Jesus says this, enter by the narrow gate, he doesn't identify who is going down the narrow path and who's going down the wide path. And that's meant to question in the people that are listening is like, which way am I going? Am I walking down the narrow path or am I walking down the wide path? And the question is for us this morning is like, which way am I going? Am I going down the popular way, the easy route, or am I going down the narrow path that actually leads to life? And I just want to finish with this. It's something that I heard yesterday. And when I heard it, I was like, gosh, that's it's a prophetic picture for us. And it might seem a little bit of a curveball from where we've been going, but stick with me. It's a verse in Genesis 4. And it's just after Cain has killed his brother Abel. And it says, Cain said to the Lord, my punishment is greater than I can bear. Behold, you've driven me away from the ground, and from your face I shall be hidden. I shall be a fugitive and wander on the earth. Then Cain went away from the presence of the Lord and settled in the land of Nod, east of Eden. There's 3 things that are going on here. So basically, sin has driven Cain away. He's killed his brother. He's committed a horrible thing. And God gives him 3 consequences. And the first one is he's driven away from himself. Says he's driven away from the ground, and a few verses, few chapters before in Genesis, Adam was made from the ground, from the dust, from the earth. So when Cain says, you've driven me away from the ground, he's actually saying, you've driven me away from myself. And then the second thing is that you've driven me away from the presence of God. And thirdly, you've driven me to a restless place. The land of Nod actually means a place of wandering, a place of restlessness. And there's this irony there when it says he settled in the land of Nod. He's driven to a restless place. And I think what this series has been doing is it's been calling us back. It's been calling us home. It's saying, come and be home in yourself. Come and be at home in yourself. This is the way you were created. This is the way you were meant to live. It says, come and be at home in my presence. and stop your restlessness, stop your wandering. And so many of us, we've got settled in the land of Nod. We've got settled in a restless and a wandering place where we're used to being restless. And God says, come home. Come home to be at home in yourself and be at home in me. And the thing is, this morning, and off the back of this series, what he says to us is, stand at the crossroads, look for the ancient paths, which is the good way, and walk in it, because there you're going to find rest for your soul.